I'm Christopher Lydon in Essex County, Massachusetts, with the novelist Paul Harding. 3 years ago, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Tinkers, that little gem of a first novel about a horse cart peddler in the backwoods of New England a century and more ago. It's the book that is still stacked up by the cash register of bookstores around the world. And now Paul Harding is about to publish a sequel called Enon, about a dark year in the present day among descendants of that same old tinker who fixed the inner works of old clocks, George Washington Crosby. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, and some local pride too. Paul, this new book cements your place, I think, as the crown prince of New England letters in a direct line that starts with Emerson and Thoreau and touches the poets Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson, among others, and maybe the late John Updike down the road too. Would you just start with that succession and why the voice of Emerson especially still resounds in Enon and in your head and mine and I think lots of others?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to talk with you again. It's my experience of all that is it's just happened on a cellular level. I don't remember ever not having the light of the New England landscape, the way that the woods look on a November afternoon, you know, when the sun's going down, the angle of that light, and, you know, having formative and normative experiences emotionally and intellectually and aesthetically and associating them with what that landscape looks like. And then part and parcel of that, as part of my schooling, you know, you read Civil Disobedience and you read the Divinity School Address, and all of a sudden there were these philosophical and intellectual and poetic artifacts that went along with and had been refracted through this landscape that to which I was native. So I grew up thinking of Thoreau and Emerson and Dickinson as Aunt Emily and Uncle Ralph, and you know, so I felt there's something almost familial. I mean, certainly cultural and communal and all that, but I also just by natural disposition feel that sort of transcendentalist. Have had that transcendentalist set of mind since I can remember. The idea of the primacy of experience, experiential. You know, the drama of consciousness is the theme.
I want to know about your transcendentalism and find out how it connects with mine and what the hell it is. I mean, they couldn't agree quite in the day what it meant. You say experience. I say something about the reality of spirit in nature. And even today, it seems to me he's a kind of beacon for people who want to believe in the, as he would say, the inward, the invisible. He says that the transcendentalist believes in miracle, in the perpetual openness of the human to new influx of light and power. He believes in inspiration and in ecstasy. That's mine, but I want to know yours. Your favorite Emerson.
Oh, I love so much of it. I love circles, you know. The eye is the first circle, and the passage about you admire this monument of granite, but this little waving hand next to it is that made it is far more important. You know, just the idea of the soul. You know, the human soul, and so he was a soulful guy, you know, and really, he was a humanist in that sense, that the individual and the individual's experiences of is precious, and that is the thing to be, always to be, that you bear witness to, and that you nurture, and that all of your mercies and kindnesses and better impulses are towards nourishing, and that in itself, it's the old I and thou. You know, I mean, I really do. I very much think of him in the Protestant lineage. There's the Unitarianism, but the Protestantism comes out of rebellion. You know, this immediacy of sacred or religious, whatever the term you'd use, experience, constantly having to dissociate itself from the calcified sort of institutional version of religion. You know, Karl Barton, Dietrich Bonhoeffer used to talk about what they called religionless Christianity. I always associate Emerson directly with that tradition of having to sort of stand up and walk out of the church in order to find what you think of as God.
Paul Harding, you're just back from Thoreau country in the wilds of Maine, rusticating in that landscape, that history. What does that do to you?
It refreshes my sense of being on a planet hurtling through space. You know, we go way, way up there off of outside of, you know, east of Moosehead Lake to out into the woods, and there's no electricity, or there's only electricity 4 hours a day, and there's the mountains, and there's the loons and the moose, and we just fly fish for brook trout out on this little pond well past darkness. And so it's so dark and so quiet, and the moon comes up over the mountains, and the sky is so dark up there, you can see the galaxy, you know, you can see the Milky Way in the sky, and you just have this real sense of hurtling through space. And I think that's a kind of Emersonian, recognizable Emerson. He's always sort of talking about the furnace of the universe and hurtling through, you know, the gulfs and the vast station, all that sort of stuff. And it's good for a sense of perspective, to refresh your sense of perspective.
But this is especially Thoreau country too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's right where it's right around where Thoreau traveled before he wrote his book, The Maine Woods. So it's all along the Penobscot River and the West Branch of the Penobscot River. And yeah, there's just that real sense of sort of as much as you can around here still get of wilderness, and it's kind of primeval landscape.
Paul, come closer to the new book, Enon. On the Emerson theme, it strikes me, I hear Emerson notes throughout it. For example, and toward the end, Charlie Crosby, the protagonist, says, "I am a connoisseur of the day." And later he refers to this awful miracle of a planet. And again, I hear Emerson, what is this thinking about in the book today?
Charlie's dealing with the death of his only child. And one of the things that I found myself preoccupied with in this book is this discrepancy between intellectually knowing better but not feeling better, or knowing what the right thing to do would be but not somehow or another not being able to bring yourself to do it. Emerson, in one of his essays, talks somewhere about how he one of the things he knows about grief, he lost his own son, is how shallow it is. And I hadn't actually had that quote in mind as I was writing Enon, but that's one of the things, I think that's analogous to what Charlie, the protagonist of Enon, struggles with, which is he knows somehow or another that it's wrong for him to pretend to utter and total tragedy, that somehow or another him, you know, he really collapses. He goes through a total sort of spiritual, physical collapse at the death of his daughter. And yet, as he sort of descends into this kind of spooky, phantasmagoric sort of inward catastrophe, there's the better part of him that knows that in a way it's a disservice to the memory of his daughter, and in a way it's a cop out in terms of he'd call it character, but it's a cop out in terms of all the other people who have suffered similar tragedies and somehow or another managed to. So, but then a lot of the book is him trying to find ways to sort of come back to that, to sort of come back to the world. And it's also a meditation on, you know, the idea that Wallace Stevens always said that poetry is essentially the act of saying yes to the world. And that echoes Martin Luther talking about always, you know, one of the challenges that this human existence always presents to us is how to find the deep and secret yes. And I think that's what Charlie is, that a lot of the book is just, again, that drama of consciousness, of experience, of him trying, and it even goes to, you know, the Gospel of John, you know, the darkness did not overcome the light, but the darkness is so great in this book that even the smallest amount of light will shine brightly and beautifully, I hope, in terms of the aesthetics of it, but any amount of light will contradict, you know, this hopelessness that he feels threatened by. It's the threat of hopelessness. And the idea, you know, he describes, it's the last line of the book, this awful miracle of a planet. I was really thinking of trying to reinvest that word awful with its traditional, its etymological meaning, which is awe. It is full of awe, and awe is it's truth and beauty, but also terror, fear and trembling, you know, and somehow integrate all of that into something that seemed finally in the end affirmative but realistic and true to experience without sentimentalizing it one way or another, trying to, you know, because I think people are sentimental about their nihilism as much as they can be about, you know, this sort of rote sort of positive attitude kind of thing. Just, I wanted it to really encompass the polarity of, you know, just the awesomeness of what it is to be human. And just in very straightforward terms, I just have a number of people with whom I'm very, very close in my life who have lost children. And, you know...
Not you.
Not me. No, I have two sons. But because the first time I became a parent, it was the first time I really realized that there was something that could happen to me in the world that would really, that could just shut my light out. You know, I could just imagine having, when I only had one son, I have two sons, but when my first son was born, I just thought, if I ever lose this person, I could just go out into the backyard and dig a hole and sit down in it. And, you know, I'm just the blues, you know, they are just the sort of that idea, you know, and so, I mean, and then that sort of relates to just my own larger motivations or more fundamental motivations for why you make art, why you put the aesthetic pressure on certain subjects or themes in order to explore them. And I just feel like with art, you don't bother making art unless everything's at stake. And so I just think of these people with whom I'm friends and I care very much about, and they've gone through these experiences. And I just thought, well, this is one of the most important things that occupies my mind. It's unsolvable. It'd be preposterous to write a book that proposed to solve it, but to have this happen to a character and just to explore that experience artistically just became, what at the outset felt like an impossible challenge, which is usually a good measure of the worth of a project. You know, I always feel like I'm onto something if I feel like the project at hand is something that I'm not talented or smart enough to pull off. And then there's, again, another paradox, which is the only way to become a good enough writer to pull off the project you're trying to pull off is to pull it off, you know. And it's, I mean, you have to be careful, it's a hall of mirrors, but there is that idea. And that's kind of from Faulkner too, you know, you have to write better than you're able to. And just that idea of trying to become equal to your subjects is very, very important.
Paul, I want you to speak about this place, Enon, in the heart of Essex County. I know Essex County in northeastern Massachusetts as a visitor. I call it Planet Essex. It's a very distinctive place. In your story, it is a couple of things. It's a kind of cemetery of New England. I mean, and there's a lot of cemetery stuff, and it feels like a cemetery of another life, including the writers Emerson Thoreau were talking about. At the same time, I mean, it's a kind of realistic day-to-day novel about America today, and there's a convenience store, and there's an Indian running it, and there are all kinds of ordinary people going to ordinary jobs, sort of what we call cranky Yankees or swamp Yankees. And in Planet Essex, as I see it, I call them planetarians. It's a very distinctive sort of person. They don't work for corporations. They don't work for governments. They fish. They're lobster fishermen or clam diggers or poets or photographers or writers or doctors or carpenters. There's every measure of person, but very few people work for the government, and they feel a very sort of Jeffersonian, yeoman, old-fashioned Americans. Were you wanting to tell us sort of what they used to be like, or that they're still here?
I think it's both. I'm fascinated by the sort of superimposition of different times. And so the idea that it's also, there's a kind of simultaneity or an eternity about it, but that when you place these Yankees for the pilgrims from the 1630s alongside some of the cranky Yankees of today, they look quite similar. And so there's something that persists. And I don't know, you know, in the DNA and the landscape, and that fascinates me. I would never be able to get to the bottom of it. To me, I've just found that the best thing I can hope for is a sort of a description that will resonate of it. I'm endlessly fascinated by it. And it's, you know, I grew up in Wenham, which is right near Essex. And Enon was actually the colonial name that, for Wenham when it was first incorporated. And I mean, I just, I, you know, my folk were school teachers and post office workers. So they did work for the government, you know, civil servants. But the stories my mother can still tell of the sort of, you know, the people that sort of still made their own clothes and cut their own hair and chopped their own wood and some of these people are still knocking around in the wood. And I just, I mean, to me, in a way, personally, it's just kind of an antidote to a lot of the homogenization and, you know, technology. I don't want to, you know, sound like I'm being, you know, kind of curmudgeon about that kind of stuff. But there's just something nice about it. There's something that's sort of removed from the, you know, the popular currents of culture, for better or for worse. And I did, I mean, for all of my, you know, kind of regular lower middle class upbringing in Wenham, and I mean, my experience, I often describe my upbringing as I grew up on the wrong side of the polo field. You know, it's a pretty blue-blooded place, Hamilton, all, you know, the horse country, and you know, all this sort of, you know, the hunt club. My grandfather was a machinist and worked at the United Shoe in Beverly, and then was he taught mechanical drawing at Beverly High School, and my grandmother worked at the post office for years. And it's a,
well, you're so right about the layering in the book. I mean, I'm thinking of that old lady in a grand old manse. She's a sort of a last survivor of the Yankee upper class, and Charlie Crosby ends up raiding her house, hoping that there are some modern drugs that will ease his pain.
Yeah, that's sort of it. That's one of the nadirs of his that year. But that, I mean, so there's, yeah, this woman named Mrs. Hale, who I mean, that estate that I'm thinking of is of course fictitious. But you know, the some of these the things that these are modeled on. I mean, I actually do remember. There's a scene in the book where he's recalling sledding with a friend down this widow's hill, you know, a hill on this widow's estate, and she sort of comes marching out, you know, talk about the cranky Yankee, and tells them that they sled like girls because they're bailing off their sleds at the bottom of the hill so they don't go crashing into the swamp. And it actually happened to me. This woman came out and she just was disgusted with us for not sledding like a real Yankee would sled her. Yeah.
Paul Harding, loop back to Enon and this book. You're not sentimentalizing or quaintifying old New England. I wonder how you came to this very grim, not unfamiliar story of a 13-year-old only child killed in a bicycle accident. How did all this descend on the Crosby family and on your imagination?
It descended on me like a sort of bolt of lightning. It's, you know, the subject choosing you or whatever the usual sort of version is. What happened is I Tinkers had come out. I didn't have an agent. I had an agent approached me, an agent who I wanted to work with, and she asked if I wanted to work with her. And I said, "Well, I don't have a manuscript. How do you know you want to work with me?" So I said, "Give me 6 months and let me see if I can come up with 50 pages of something." And it was a good motivation for me to just get started on another book. So I started I aligned my brain into sort of being receptive to just anything, just the little spark, the little first image or whatever of a novel that you can start exploring and interrogating and discovering the implications of. And the Enon just came to me in the form of a very sort of visual image in my mind of it was a silhouette, and it was just a sort of exaggerated, almost caricature silhouette of a very steep little New England hill that was studded with headstones. And at the top of this hill was the silhouette of a man sort of creeping across. You could almost see the moon above him. And I just knew all at once that this was Charlie Crosby, that it was very late at night, that he was sort of skulking back to his house after ranging the hills and the rivers and the you know, and the meadows of Enon, you know, and he had been up to no good. And I also knew at the same time that down at the bottom of that hill in front of him was where his daughter was buried, and that he was sneaking behind her headstone because he was ashamed of what he had been up to and what had become of him since her death. Simple as that, you know. And so then I just wrote that up and I just started to unfold it. It's almost, you just sort of unfold it, a sentence, an image, an idea, a subject at a time, and it at first it's this big sort of dust cloud, and then it becomes, as they say, planetesimal. You know, things start to accrete, and it starts to all take on a common orbit, and things start to resolve out of it. And before I knew it, I felt like I was in over my head. I just thought, oh, you know, a novel about a guy who loses his only child. And I thought, well, there's the challenge, is you can't make it just another novel about a person who loses an only child. You know, it's just a matter of how you think of it, because every novel you read, you could sort of, if you use the right sarcastic tone of voice, sort of reduce by, you know, coming up with a description of it that makes it sound cliche. But then I started thinking about, I mean, this is parental love. It's the father's love for his daughter. But I started thinking about Orpheus and Eurydice, and I started thinking about Persephone and Demeter, you know, going down into the underworld and trying to fetch back a loved one, and just thought, well, you know, this is biblical tragedy, it's Greek tragedy, it's Shakespearean tragedy, you know, it's tragedy. And I started thinking, the patron, you know, the guardian angel of Enon is Emily Dickinson, with all of her first person posthumous poems. She made the boundary between this life and death permeable, and she regularly steps back and forth. And I just thought, what a beautiful thing to try to do, and to give my protagonist a little bit of that kind of literacy. One of the chapters in Enon actually ends with him recalling a line from Emily Dickinson. It's that regret is the adequate of hell, and I think it's unnamed in the book. So just that idea, and I just thought, well, so I have a kind of a ghost story on my hand, and it's very tragic, and it's very sad. And so I can't, one wrong step to the left or to the right, and I'm going to lapse into sentimentality. And I just thought, well, again, there's that challenge that makes it worth trying to just write about how it really would be, and to sustain, just to sustain that intensity of observation and description, so that I never did wrong by him, and therefore wrong by all the people who inspired the book in the first place, or where I feel like that idea came out of. And then the book just kept getting darker and darker and darker, because the premises are, it's not like he's suddenly going to come to, you know, he's the end of this book is not suddenly the light shines and peace descends upon him, and it's a very, very sort of qualified kind of thing.
You mean a shaky recovery?
Yeah, right. He sort of he survives, but he sort of survives by crawling from the wreckage, you know, of circumstance, but also of his own making in some ways. So it was fascinating. It was very, you know, it was tough to write. What good is it to try to write a book that you think you can write? You know, why bother?
But then there are all kinds of pressures on a guy who's had an amazing success. I mean, I don't go into any bookstores that don't have you, you know, all over the place. 3 years later, after the prize, 4 years after, we had a wonderful conversation about it. But what are the commercial pressures? What are even the satisfy the audience pressures that were bearing down on you?
The short answer is that, you know, sometimes in my private time, alone time, 4 a.m, wide awake in bed, I think, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to do that? How am I ever going to follow this up? You know, these sort of external pressures. But then the sort of better part of me thinks, you should be so lucky that your problem in life is following up your Pulitzer Prize winning debut novel. Like, it's a pretty good problem to have. And so it's just this idea of, you can't get too up on it or down on it. You have to be a very sober Calvinistic sort of, you don't want to, I think of all the success that Tinker's had, the worldly success it had with the prize and being, you know, selling well, is a kind of vote of confidence. And you want to be equal to that. You want to be equal to the goodwill that people have shown you. I think, and this is where, again, going back to how the story of how Tinker's, it's very difficult to get Tinker's published, and it sat in the proverbial and literal desk drawer for 5 years. That really has borne me in good stead, because I spent 5 years making art for art's sake, and then for the fruition or the consequence of those 5 years was Tinker's being published and doing so well. There's nothing in that experience to dissuade me from thinking I'll just keep making art for art's sake despite these other circumstances. And over those 5 years, I cultivated and evolved the discipline of just being able to make the world go away, and just it's just you and the work of art.
Paul, we got to talk about music. You and I realized years later that we had been in the same room listening to Elvin Jones, the great Coltrane drummer, years ago. You heard him deeper and many more times than I did. But you've spoken before with me about, you know, two hands and two legs making music in a kind of counterpoint with itself as a version of the writing process. So, among other things, I read Enon, listening for many levels, but listening for Elvin. I think I found him in a few places, and we could talk about him, but are we still writing rhythms?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going back all full circle back to Emerson, or we maybe never left, but that moment of fully inhabiting the moment and the idea of improvisation. And you know, this moment, the experience of this moment has its own integrity. And when you're a musician or a writer or a painter or a dancer, you translate the experience of that moment into your medium. And so it becomes this high level of improvisation. So if you're Elvin Jones and you're trying to make art that will engage the complexity of the human mind. And so Elvin Jones uses all four limbs and all sorts of different tempos and textures and juxtapositions in order to make this elegant whole. And that's what I just think of trying to do with writing, making writing that is, and what better medium than language, to the medium that has the capacity to hold in itself the degree and type of complexity that will satisfy an engaged and amenable reader.
Got to say, Paul, Tinker's fans will be relieved that the Clockworks reappear in Enon. Would you read that passage where Charlie Crosby remembers being out with his grandfather, George Washington Crosby, on a clock mission?
Sure. They've gone to a woman's house to fix a grandfather clock, which is if you repair clocks, you tend to try to fix those at the person's house because they're difficult to transport. So this is his grandfather instructing him in this particular case. "Open the case and take the weight off," my grandfather said. He handed me an old-fashioned key he'd taken from the front ledge of the hood before we had removed it. I inserted the key into the keyhole and opened the door. The old air fell out of the clock, dry, held in the cubic shape of the case for who knows how many years until I opened the door and it collapsed out into the contemporary atmosphere, distinct and nearly colonial for a moment, and then subsumed, and I wondered how old it was, if it contained any of Simon Willard's breath. The clock was made by an old clock maker named Simon Willard from the early 19th century. I lifted the lead weight and unhooked it from its pulley wheel. It felt like removing the heavy heart of the clock. I laid the weight on a rug at the foot of the stairs. It thudded onto the wool like an object from another outsized planet with twice the gravity of our own. A heavy lead heart, I thought. That has to do, too, with the burning ember in the center of the house. "Get that flashlight," my grandfather said. "Shine it down right there, and let's see what's what with this tricky little son of a beach." I stood at the foot of the stepladder with the flashlight held above my head, pointing down at the works and the chains depending from them, while my grandfather fiddled around, pulling and poking and muttering and humming to himself. I looked at the furniture and the paintings and the rugs and the sconces. I tried to see through doorways into other rooms.
There's music in that, Paul.
I hope so. I mean, I still think, I mean, to me, I still try to write, I still think very lyrically, as if it's almost like poetry and scenes like that, and trying to find the rhythm of description and trying to find the time signature of the description, the meter of description.
What's the time signature in what you just read, and what's the meter? Explain.
I don't, you know, just trying to find the rhythm of moving from one detail in the scene to the next, and trying to find the right rhythm where you're going to go from, say, you know, three parts concrete description that will earn you the right to a little bit of embellishment, you know, the personification of the clock, the weights as the clock's heart, and all of those sorts of things. So it's a kind of, I don't know, it's a sort of advance and retreat. So I don't know, maybe it's in free verse or free time, maybe a little bit more like Ornette Coleman or something like that, and that maybe a little more third stream and that. In that again, it's that the tentativeness, the improvisation. I mean, when I read that out loud, I it's sometimes it's hard for me to read those passages because I don't know where they're going to land, because rereading them is just like the process of writing them again, which is when I wrote them I didn't know where I was going to land either. It's sort of interesting to reproduce those like that. It's funny too, because with Enon, I mean, going along with the musical analogy, Tinkers felt like it was much more fully free-form improvisation. I was just thinking about Ornette Coleman and the double quartet and all that. Whereas Enon has it's a little bit more arranged. There's a little bit more of an arrangement in some ways. And then there are smaller improvisational sections within a more formal arrangement in some ways.
You've used that word humanistic several times, which is for me, I notice it everywhere. We're hungering in this digital economy, you know, financialized world, scientific sense of the genome, all of this stuff. I think we're searching for the human story again. And I find it wonderfully satisfying what you've done in Enon, to be with a man in a year after terrible loss, and it's all very, very direct.
Yeah, I think that's a good description of what proved to be the sort of primary discipline for writing the book, was just staying with his humanity and not lapsing into rhetoric or not lapsing into kind of au courant metaphors about grief, this and the stages of the process of that. It may prove that, you know, people who know about such things will be able to see that. You know, it may be that those are subsequent descriptions to sort of natural organic. But I really just wanted to just stick with this guy, sort of thought by thought, moment by moment, impulse by contradictory impulse, and not try to simplify anything. To go into the full frustrating, grief-stricken kind of complexity of his experience, and just sort of let it end where it may, you know, and without knowing anything more than, he was looking for the deep and secret yes, as it were, that he was trying to maintain hope against hopelessness, or in the face of apparent hopelessness, and just thinking that that's an essential story that humans and humanists tell and listen to and trade back and forth to, you know, that just that idea. I mean, I still have this idea that art is essentially a gesture of fellowship. And this is not a new idea, you know, just the idea that it's another human voice speaking, and that you can hear in somebody saying, I've thought about this too, I've experienced that. The idea, the very powerful effect that all art has of recognition. I mean, in some ways, we're not digital. Our artifacts are increasingly digital. And I think it's a sort of gesture against material culture in the fact of sort of objectifying experience, which I think actually in some strange backhanded way actually comes out of a very human impulse, which is, you know, call us apes, call us parallel processors, just don't call us messy, imperfect humans. But at the end of the day, that always strikes the most authentic note, is to present each other to each other in all of our kind of, you know, bloody, messy, you know, imperfect essence.
Paul Harding, it's a joy to read your new work. It's a great privilege to hear you talk about it. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. These conversations are always wonderful.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Paul Harding. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for the novel Tinkers. His second novel, coming in September, is titled Enon. to the New England town where the Crosby family saga continues into the present day. Listeners, please leave your comment about Tinkers, about transcendentalism, about playing with time in prose and in music at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.